Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here, and welcome back. Today's a full show, so let's dive right in. First up, I have a short conversation with Liz Winstead, the founder of Abortion Access Front. As you probably know by now, Feminist Book Club donates 5% of every sale to a different feminist organization each month. Our November charity is the Abortion Access Front, so Liz joins me to explain a bit about what they do. Then we'll move into our regularly scheduled author interview with Stephanie Jimenez. She's the author of the new book, They Could Have Named Her Anything. Stephanie and I chat about writing characters that inhabit this elusive space between empowerment and victimhood. It's such a great topic. We cover lots of topics, but that's my favorite part, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. And just a reminder, it's your last chance to sign up for the Feminist Book Club subscription box to get our November box, which features the book Know My Name by Chanel Miller, plus products from Vixx Baking Company, Soak It Up Cloths, Oh It's Natural Skincare, and more. Head over to feministbookclub.com/shop and use promo code podcast for $5 off. Remember, you can join us from anywhere, since our book discussions are all done on video chat and we ship worldwide, so you have no excuses. We can't wait to meet you. Now, here is my quick chat with Liz. I'm sitting down with Liz Winstead, who is the founder of the Abortion Access Front, and I'm going to have her take it away. Hi, Liz. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be talking to a fellow Minnesotan, a fellow feminist, and somebody who actually wants to center abortion in a conversation, which is very hard to get people to do.
So what is the Abortion Access Front?
So the Abortion Access Front is a nonprofit that I started around 2015. Used to be called Lady Parts Justice League, but we renamed it so we could be more intersectional and inclusive, and also center abortion. And we are a group of comedians and writers and activists, you name it, creative types and activists, who decided that we really wanted to use our work to talk about access to abortion and the erosion and what it means. Me coming from comedy, I really wanted to use humor to expose all these bad actors who profess to be care about the sanctity of life, yet I've never seen them at one march about family separation at the borders. I've never seen them actually refer to pregnant people as somebody we should consider when we're talking about reproductive care and all of that. And then also exposing people who are coming up with crackpot theories like, oh, I don't know, abortion reversal, or that ectopic pregnancies could be reimplanted into the uterus by some magical unicorn medical thing that they've made up into their heads. So,
are there people that actually think that?
There are people that are actually proposing legislation.
Oh, cool.
Literally not be able to perform abortions for an ectopic pregnancy because they say that you can take the fertilized egg from a fallopian tube and somehow reimplant it magically into a uterus.
Fascinating.
Yes, that's exactly.
Not real. No. So you take comedy to kind of deconstruct these narratives. What is your background in comedy and abortion?
Well, my background in comedy is I started out right in Minneapolis, Minnesota, doing stand-up back in the bad old 1980s. And then I became a touring comic, did a bunch of specials on TV, started dabbling in writing. And I think what most people know me for is co-creator and former head writer of The Daily Show and launching that into the strata. And then I moved on to create a radio network called Air America Radio, where I had a radio show with Rachel Maddow and Chuck D for a couple of years. And then I wrote a book called Liz Free or Die. I did a bunch of other TV stuff. And then I realized that I was pretty decent at using humor to expose hypocrisy, and that the media and even fellow progressives were not very decent at talking about the issue that is most legislated, talking about an issue that literally strips bodily autonomy away from people, over 50% of the people who have a uterus, and acting like it's a wedge issue. And I really wanted to have a conversation around access to reproductive care, access to abortion, also say the word abortion so that we could actually bring it into a conversation. If we don't name it, we can't defend it. If we can't defend it, then we are going to be always on the defensive, trying to fight these battles. And if I have to constantly be working in a stigmatized environment around reproductive health, I'm just never going to be able to win hearts and minds and have conversations that are real. So we use humor to expose these issues. We have a daily Facebook Live that we have been experimenting with for about 6 months. We have a fantastic social media presence on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Access Front. And then the second thing we do, and maybe the most important thing we do, is I'm on the road about 4 months out of the year with a bunch of comics, and we do shows and then combine our comedy shows, comedy and music shows, with an activism talk back with local activists and providers in communities in the hardest hit spaces in America. That way, we bring people in, our fan base in, through comedy and music, and then the activists who are doing the real work on the ground and the providers who are giving the care, we have a conversation in front of our audience to say, here's what's happening in your state, here are the issues, here's where we need you to help. And then those local audiences can sign up right there at our show, and we grow activist spaces all around the country. In fact, we've been working with folks in Minnesota all summer with Unrestrict Minnesota, which is a campaign to get a draconian abortion laws off the books in Minnesota, and to say, look, why do we have unconstitutional laws on the books in Minnesota? This is crazy, especially since a whole spate of those laws were snuck in during a bill that was about circuses. Yeah.
That caught me off guard.
I know, right? You would not expect it. You can go to the Unrestrict Minnesota website and find our video that we made. We did a parody of Comedy Central's Drunk History called Sober History. And it's me telling the story of how these laws came to pass. And it sounds like a story that a drunk person would tell, but I was totally sober. We are looking for volunteers right now. This is sort of great. So clinics come to us and also say, we need XYZ. Can you help us? So the Robbinsdale Clinic, who I love dearly and they're friends, they have had a massive amount of branching and leaf work just like all over their lawn, and they need some volunteers to help rake and get rid of branches from weather in Minnesota. So if you want to be helpful, you can email anna@aafront.org. She's our volunteer coordinator, and we want to get a bunch of people out there to just do some lawn care for the clinic, because that is sort of our jam. We've redone gardens for clinics. We have repainted exam rooms, we fixed fences, made like homemade heating pad covers for aftercare for patients that are personalized. So anytime the clinics need some care like that, we like to provide it. We also like to provide self-care for people who provide the care, because I've visited about, to this point in my career, almost 150 clinics. And the thing that is the overarching thing is, as we're trying to combat these laws, people are still providing the care and people are still getting the care. And a lot of times at the end of the day, it's really stressful to have to walk through a throng of people who are telling you that you're a murderer, who follow you home at night, who you have to drive home a different way every day just for your own safety from the work that you do. It's important for us that we can do everything in our power, whether it's grow activist bases or whether it's provide self-care ourselves in the form of bringing a masseuse in, delivering cupcakes, whatever we can do to say we see you, we value you, and we want you to know that we care about you and we're so thrilled you're in our community. That's really important for us too. So did I explain all that correctly?
Yes. Really want to nail this part of it, because I think that it's so important. The work that you do to take care of clinic workers and abortion providers is incredible. No one else is doing it to the level that you all are doing it.
Right.
It's a way to say thank you to people that go to battle for us every day and go to battle for our rights every day. And so I want to say Thank you to the Abortion Access Front for doing that work. We are honored to name them as our November charity of the month. So 5% of all of our sales will go to the Abortion Access Front. And that's sales, you guys. That's not profit. That is 5%, one nickel, 5 cents of every dollar will go back to the Abortion Access Front this month. So
we feel so honored about that, you know, and especially in my home state where, you know, things come around in such a profound way. I had an abortion at 16 in Minnesota. I was in an abusive relationship. I didn't know how to get out of that relationship. But the one thing I knew for sure is that if I carried a pregnancy and had a kid with that person, that I would never probably get out. And so it was a long road for me to try to find access. I ended up at one of those fake abortion clinics that lie to patients, and they look like clinics, but they're really not. And I was really shamed there. And I ended up at a clinic that was called Midwest Health Center for Women. And I was able to get my abortion without judgment and stigma. And then years later, my best friend bought that clinic and owns it. And it's now called Whole Winds Health. To be able to have those things converge, it's pretty magical. So it feels pretty great.
For local listeners, we've got listeners all over the country and all over the world, but I know we've got a good chunk of you here at the Twin Cities. You are doing a show here soon, is that right?
That is right. So every year I do a big recap of the year. I do 3 shows at the Cedar Cultural Center. It's called Snarknado 10.
Snarknado.
It's going to be great. So all of the information about that, you can find it on the Cedar website, and all the information for the shows are there. It's going to be a gas.
We'll leave links to that in the show notes. The tickets just went on sale too. We'll leave all the information for Abortion Access Front in the show notes as well. Liz, this has been a delight. Thank you so, so much again for the work you do and for joining me on such short notice.
Well, thank you so much for actually uplifting the work and for being somebody who understands that we got to say abortion, we got to talk about it because it's part of healthcare.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Isn't Liz amazing? Before we started recording, I had to tell her that the reason I'm even remotely involved in political issues today is because of The Daily Show. It was such an honor to be able to personally thank her for such an important cultural artifact, important to me at least. My first paper in college was written about The Daily Show. I'm so glad we're supporting Abortion Access Front this month because the work they do is so necessary. Now, here is today's interview with Stephanie Jimenez. Welcome back, everyone. Today I'm sitting down with Stephanie Jimenez. Stephanie Jimenez is the author of the novel They Could Have Named Her Anything. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The Guardian, O, the Oprah magazine, Joyland magazine, The New York Times, and more. She is a former Fulbright recipient and graduate of Scripps College in Claremont, California, which makes her a fellow Women's College alum. She is currently based in Queens, New York, and her debut novel, which we'll be talking about today, was just published on August 1st, 2019 from Little A Books. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to chat with you today. I start every interview with the same question, and that is, what is your definition of feminism?
My definition of feminism has changed a lot throughout the years. Growing up, I had a family that was very male-centric in the sense that I had a lot of brothers. There were just lots of men in my family. And I grew up not knowing about feminism as a system, but more just lessons about girlhood in general that I was getting passed down from the women in my family. And that to some extent felt very, very secret, very much for me and not for the ears of the boys in my family. And I think that that was my first inkling that to be a girl was something very different than to be a boy. And that there were these messages and lessons that I would be receiving that would add up to something special about the way that I would move in the world. I went to an all-girls high school, and there too, I was learning all of these different things about what it meant to be a girl. And there was this funny kind of sense of empowerment and the idea that girls can achieve whatever they want and do whatever they want. And yet at the all-girls school, there was also this emphasis on politeness and on being, you know, presentable and crossing your legs. And so there was something that was, I wouldn't call feminism now looking back on it. And it wasn't until I got to college, and I went to an all-women's college, that I really began to piece together what feminism meant to me. And I started to read the works of women of color feminists. And from those writings and from the idea that the experiences of women, and particularly women of color, was worthy of documenting and worthy of being talked about and to talk about, that was, I think, my first kind of, my first willingness to use the term feminist. And apply it to my life and who I was.
Do you identify as a woman of color?
Yes.
Yeah. What's your heritage, if you don't mind me asking?
My mother was born in Colombia and my father was born in Costa Rica.
So before we started chatting, I mentioned that we're recording during Latinx Heritage Month. Unfortunately, this will be out after it ends, but it just feels like a really nice way to celebrate that. So I'm really grateful that we have these kinds of stories, especially during this month, but also all year round. And I think that I think white feminism is an issue. And the fact that you came to feminism at your women's college, as did I, but being a woman of color in higher education can be really difficult. So tell me a little bit about that experience and how you kind of, did you ever feel uncomfortable in feminism, or was it like, oh no, this is right. I am reading these, you know, womanists and women of color and Black feminism, Chicana feminism. Like, was there ever a moment where you didn't feel like it was for you, or you felt, did you ever feel seen? That was so many questions. I'm so sorry.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. So there were very distinct spaces that I remember on campus along the lines of race. And where I think that I found my particular entry point to feminism was in a space that was specifically for other Latina students. And whereas I was part of, you know, I was part of the group on campus that was specifically for Latina students, and we would, you know, meet every week and just talk about what was going on in our lives, some of the issues we were facing on campus, and some of our joys as well. There were other spaces that I was part of, which included this radical coffee shop, where I think the most, you know, feminist-minded, just like cool, very, you know, like kombucha drinking, like ahead of the curve, you know, just like very progressive, cool space. And I was a barista there. And I do remember I was probably the only, if not just like one of two, I really can't even think of another Latina barista in that space. And everyone else was overwhelmingly white. And that was a space where, like, you know, I felt like my politics certainly aligned. Like, I think I was just as progressive. And if I had felt more welcome, like, I could have been more inclined to hang out in that space and to make friends with the people who were there. For me, feminism and my identity as a woman of color has never been something that I can separate. And so when I was engaging with my feminism, I don't know if I was doing it consciously and without engaging with my identity as a person of color as well. I think they would both happen at the same time. Whereas I would see in other spaces that were primarily made of white students, like this coffee house that I worked at that was very radical and progressive, everything was centered around womanhood and what it meant to be a woman and feminism in particular. It was just so much more single issue, I think, than what I was experiencing in these spaces where we weren't just women, we were also women of color. We weren't just women of color, we were also women from lower socioeconomic backgrounds than most of our peers. So there wasn't just this single issue that would unite us, which was, I think, you know, feminism as an idea, as a concept on campus, but rather all of these different intersecting parts of our identity. And that felt more like a space where I could be, where I can encompass my particular brand of feminism in line with all of the other things that I cared about and affected my life.
So much of what you're saying mimics the grappling and tensions that occur in your book. They could have named her anything, particularly your main character, Maria, goes to an all-girls high school that is upper middle class or upper echelons, really, and primarily white. Can you give us just an overview of the book to introduce our listeners to it so they can join the conversation?
Sure. So my book, They Could Have Named Her Anything, follows Maria Rosario, who is a Latina teenager from a working class neighborhood in Queens. She is accepted at a very elite, prestigious private high school on the Upper East Side, and the book follows her as she encounters obstacles and struggles at her school and is torn between these two worlds of going to school in this very prestigious place, and then also coming from a community that doesn't have access to all of the resources that her wealthy white peers have. The book is also told through the perspectives of Maria and her best friend's father. So there's four alternating perspectives. It's Maria, her best friend Rocky, and their fathers.
Why did you choose to include the fathers?
I think that it was important for me to try to create a conversation that I think I wish that I had had growing up. And that's in terms of just as someone who had an education that was often catered only to girls, right? I went to an all-girls high school. I went to an all-women's college. Our spaces can be so gender segregated. And to me, it was writing this book where I could incorporate the perspectives of both fathers and daughters was a needed conversation and a way for me to bridge the gap between what I think are often just these perspectives that are at odds and that don't understand each other because we live in a society where gender is kept at such a binary and we don't get to talk about these really important things in our lives with men as often as we should and we need to.
Tell me more about the gender and sexuality angle in this book, because I think we, in terms of intersectionality, we do have a lot of conversations and the book deals greatly with race and class. But I know that you are a little, you've come accustomed to talking about that. And one of the things that you'd like to talk a little bit more is the gender and sexuality. So tell me about how that is incorporated in the book.
So I wanted to write a book in which a young girl is struggling to learn about her sexuality and really doesn't have the resources to do so. And to me, that was important because I come from a background working in reproductive justice and reproductive rights. So I've worked at Planned Parenthood. I've worked for Rewire.news, which is a nonprofit dedicated specifically to reporting on reproductive justice. And something that I would see over and over again is that these conversations about sexuality are so limited because we're not taking into account the fact that so many young people, as they're coming into their sexuality, don't actually have the information they need to make informed decisions and to actually make decisions around, for example, consent, or learning about healthy relationships or learning what feels good and what doesn't feel good. So for me, it was important to have this character who is moving through a world that is as dangerous as ever for young girls and for women in particular, and not having that information and what it could look like for her to try to navigate her sexuality and her decisions around her sexual life virtually on her own. And even in these spaces, she is a student at a all-girls school where talking about sex or what she's experiencing as a girl is taboo. And how does she do that? And what are the kinds of things and situations that she'll have to navigate with such limited resources? And so to me, it was important to portray an honest depiction of what it could be like to be a young girl growing up in our world, and especially I think in a city where, I think you become aware of your body through other people's eyes. You become aware of your body because other people point it out to you before you even learn about it in some cases. And definitely in Maria's case where, she walks down the street and getting hollered at is, one of the first experiences that she has and realizing like, oh, I am a sexual being now.
Mm-hmm. I felt so much kindred spirit with Maria, thinking back to my sexual experiences as a teenager and seeing a lot of the same situations play out in your book. It was heartbreaking, but also like normalized. Like, this is what happens. It doesn't mean it's good. It's actually terrible. But it was a very real portrayal of the kinds of experiences that girls blossoming on womanhood experience. You have an article on Literary Hub that I absolutely adored, and it talks about how you came to write Maria and the complexities of her, going through this transition from girlhood to womanhood and your own experiences. And one of the questions you pose is, how do you write a woman in a world where everyone hates her? Can you either answer that question or talk a little bit more about how you came to that question and that article itself? I mean, we will link the article because it is phenomenal.
Yeah, so I lifted that line from Jessica Valenti, actually, because it's the question that she poses of how does a woman behave in a world that hates her, live her life in a world that hates her. And part of, you know, writing the character of Maria, part of the reason why it was so complex was because all of the decisions that she makes are subject to judgment, and specifically because she is a young girl. You know, there's so much that she has to deal with in terms of like navigating, you know, being called, for example, a slut, or being, you know, or being called by her boyfriend a prude, or there's all of these different ways in which her decisions are limited by the perception, by the negative perceptions of those around her. And I think the struggle for me in writing this character in particular was that I wanted to write this honest depiction of a girl who would very much be subjected to danger, to sexual danger in particular, but to many different kinds of dangers as a young woman of color, in a world that is not welcoming of her identity in any way. And one of the struggles that I came up against was how do I depict that? How do I depict the hardship of that without robbing my character of what makes her human, right? So like her happiness and her joy and the things that she loves. I think it's one of the traps of writing marginalized characters is that you risk writing them as victims, right? Because you want to get to that pain. You want to show what it is that they're going through. You want to educate people on what it is like to live in a marginalized body. And yet, how do you do that with also making sure that you're not depriving your character of joy and that you're making them fully human and you're giving them what they need to actually look just as appealing and interesting and feeling as any other character who gets to do that because they're not marginalized. There's a balancing act. And then on the other extreme of it, there's the trap of writing a marginalized character as a superhero, right? Who will just always prevail over any kind of trial or obstacle that they face. And that's the idea, this kind of simplistic version of empowerment. And so to find the space between empowerment and victimhood, and centering Maria at that as a teenage woman of color from a low economic background, from an immigrant family, was a real challenge.
Do you think you succeeded?
Yes, I think so. I think after many drafts, what I needed to do was find Maria's personality and find what was in her heart. And I think that one of the ways that I did that was through her love of poetry and writing. So something that I think a lot of readers have pointed out as the most like surprising and most endearing thing about her is her genuine love for Emerson's poetry. And so she's reading Emerson in her English classes because that's what's assigned, that's what's part of the literary canon. And she loves it. She genuinely loves it. And she identifies this concept of the sublime, and she's able to apply it to her own life, right? Emerson wrote about it in the sense of nature and being in nature and experiencing the sublime there. And Maria, who's growing up in this really gritty city and a gritty part of the city, is able to take the sublime and see it while she's walking down this huge boulevard full of cars. And so for her, so adding that, for example, I think was pivotal. It was just like a small thing where you could just see into who she is, like beyond just the dangers that are befalling her.
Mm-hmm. Beyond just a teenager who's making mistakes and doing their best in the world. That's what I think, we don't give a lot of credit to teenagers, that they have these like fully formed lives and loves and interests. And it didn't surprise me that she you know, latched on to Emerson just the same way that I latched on to Dorothy Parker as a teenager. You know, like teenagers are weird and quirky and so smart, but they just sometimes make terrible choices. Yeah. So it felt really, yeah, it was really endearing. And it's interesting that you say now that that was kind of your avenue to explore her a little bit more.
Yeah. And it was just one of the, I think it was missing from the beginning when I first started to write her. And then as I just developed her character more and wanted to explore who she was, it was thinking about things like that kind of surprised me too, and made me just question who this person was. And there was more than just the boxed identity that she came in, right? And it actually took me thinking back on like my own teenage years and what were the books that moved me at that time. And I remembered that I loved no book more than Wuthering Heights when I was a teenager.
Really?
And yeah, and it was just, and I think remembering that also sparked something in me that like, if I'm writing a character, you know, that is so much, this book is so much about representation. And right now, I think in particular, we're having, the literary world is being much more thoughtful about the representation of people of color in books and marketing to people of color, readers of color. And I wanted to think in ways that would, you know, just add more complexity to like, oh, like Latina girl reads, you know, Latina writers, or like has like this like culture that I think would just like immediately be related to like her Latinidad. What are like the things that she's consuming that could like question that, right? Or like that don't so narrowly fit, I think, into like what stereotypically is associated with a young Latina girl. And Emerson is I think so perfect in that sense, as is Wuthering Heights.
That's amazing. Yeah, and I think it just speaks volumes to how important it is for own voices literature that people of color are writing stories about people of color, and it's not just some like well-meaning white lady writing about a Latina girl who loves Frida Kahlo or something, you know, like right. It's really easy for more privileged voices to make really blind assumptions and stereotypes. And so it's what's so beautiful about having a growing diversity of authors and publishers, thank God, are now seeing the importance of that, is we get these complex stories about, you know, Latina girls that love Emerson. I love it.
Right. And I think it's exactly that. It's just where's like the complexity, and how do we get to that? And how do we not flatten characters? And that's hard for anyone, you know? And when you add like, just like these notions of like what your responsibility is when you're writing about certain marginalized groups and questions of representation, it becomes even more complex.
Mm-hmm. How does that complexity play out in the friendship between Maria and her best friend, Rocky, who is a like one percenter white girl?
It's really interesting. So they become friends in the context of this oppressive school that they both go to, where they both feel like outsiders. And Rocky too has, I think she is somewhat of a rebel at this private school, and her sexuality too, you know, she shows up to class with a Planned Parenthood sticker on her laptop, and, you know, teachers side-eye her. And there's this idea that like they become friends because they both feel like outsiders, despite Maria being, you know, like on a full scholarship and Rocky having just enough money to take Maria on lavish vacations and basically do whatever she wants. They connect in this way. It's like, you know, they're kindred because they're both young women trying to adapt to this confusing world and this set of rules that have been imposed on them at the school that they're in. And so that, I wanted to keep that complexity intact, right? Like Rocky is not just this poor little rich girl character who's just, you know, like that's one dimensional in that way. I wanted to give her, in the same way that I gave Maria the kind of thought and complexity that she needed, I wanted to give Rocky that too. And you see it in her. She's a character that I think has been conditioned to be tough, which I think happens to a lot of young women while they're growing up, before they discover the concept of feminism and before they are able to understand their position as just one of many and to contextualize it as like a pattern in our society. And so Rocky's growing up feeling that she is very much alone and she has to develop this tough exterior. And she and Maria, she kind of takes Maria under her wing to show her the ways of what that looks like. You know, she is like Maria's first, the first person who tells Maria that men are shit, for example. And she's like, yeah, you know, I got that from my mom. And so she's kind of opening Maria's eyes to like, you know, the ways in which, you know, their future relationships with men and with the world in general will progress. And so they become teachers for each other. One of the things that I love about Rocky too is that, you know, these are both, they're both 17-year-old girls, and that's a time in their lives where they haven't really found their place yet. They don't know the people who they're going to grow into. And I think that as we get older, our friendships become much less intimate because we are so sure of who we are and who we don't want to be. And Rocky and Maria are so in that stage where they're forming their personalities and they're much more open to seeing each other's lives. And so Rocky just, you know, without hesitating, invites Maria to come over her apartment. And Maria knows that that's a gift. That's a form of intimacy. And I wanted to depict that because I thought that was a really important way in which these two girls start to bond, and an important depiction of friendship between people who are very different that I don't think is possible if you're situating that friendship between adults with very separate lives. Like, these two characters almost have malleable personalities at this point in their lives, and so they're able to kind of slip in and out of each other despite like their in many ways, like their ignorance of each other and the many mistakes that they make because they're young. They also have this really rare gift of intimacy in their friendship that I think I really wanted to shine through.
Yeah, and it does toe the line at times of between intimacy and enmeshment. And I think that is so common for a lot of female friendships, particularly young ones. And you handled that beautifully. I have to admit, I wrote down toughness as survival prior to discovering feminism, because when you said that, I actually got goosebumps. That just speaks to like 17, 18, 19-year-old Renee. Like,
yeah.
You have to be tough in order to be in this world, and feminism kind of opens your mind a little bit more that no, you don't.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the early lessons of you have to protect yourself. Yeah. You know, you have to look out for yourself. And when I was talking about what I grew up with before I even heard the term feminism, the lessons I was receiving was, you know, don't go out at this time if something happens to you that's primarily your fault. Like, you didn't protect yourself enough. Like, you didn't, like, don't be stupid. You know, like, that was the lesson. Like, don't be silly. Don't be stupid. Don't put yourself in danger.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, reflected a lot in the book. And one of the primary things that makes it so hard for Maria to make good decisions, because that's really the only lesson that she's being given. And in both directions, both in this like very wealthy school that she's attending and at her home. I think that there is, you know, it's not, I've had a couple of readers point out that there is a level of machismo in the book, in Maria's family, that is particular to Latinx culture. While I do recognize that, and I think it's true that I've written that into the book, I think that there is an encompassing form of misogyny that's happening in all of the spaces that Maria is interacting with. And the men that, you know, she's coming into contact due to her involvement in this school are just as bad, if not worse, in terms of the kinds of beliefs that they hold about women and the way they treat women. So I would push back on this idea that, like, you know, we talk so much about, like, I can remember conversations in college about feminism that we would be comparing, you know, what our, like, kind of Western feminism look like versus, like, other like feminisms in different countries internationally. And I think that happens sometimes too with, like, you know, what is people of color's feminism looks like in terms of white women's feminism. And we tend to think that, you know, I think mainstream white feminism has progressed more than like people of color's feminism, even this through this idea of machismo, oh, like Latinx men are so machista. But I would want to question that a little bit and kind of push people to think a little bit further about that before posing that, or just being able to locate the machismo in my book. Like there's so much misogyny in general that can be associated with just white mainstream culture in my book as well. And we should be noticing that too.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that it's easy, especially for white readers, to recognize this machismo theme because we are so blind to the white patriarchy that is everywhere. It's one of those things, like once you see it, you can't unsee it, but it takes kind of lifting the curtain in order to see it first. And so if you're not quite there yet, the machismo is a little more obvious.
Right.
So we are actually running low on time. So I always ask everyone, if you have a book that's not yours that you would like to recommend to our readers/listeners, what would that be?
I am currently reading a book that is a memoir from a Chicana punk rock artist named Alice Bag. And she was one of the like only female punk rock Chicanas on the scene in Los Angeles at the time that she was making music in the 80s. And I picked it up on a whim because I'd been hearing her name recently in a lot of like just progressive Latina spaces as someone who was really a model for Latina and Chicana outsiders, because she was doing something that really broke the mold of what Latinas could do. And so I picked up her book, and it is such a fascinating account of how she started playing music, her family life, navigating, you know, these kind of, as a woman of color, these in-between worlds of going back down to Mexico and then coming back to LA, and what she was experiencing as a woman of color at the time. And she's still making music too. So it's exciting to be able to read something that was, I think, you know, she paved the way for a lot of people in that music scene to come after her and to look up to and to see themselves beyond, you know, the stereotypical mold of what does it mean to be a Latina woman modeled after someone like J-Lo or like some Hayek, or, you know, like there was, she's opened up, or she's one of the people who's opened up what it could be, you know, beyond just our typical stereotypes of Latinas. And so reading her memoir right now is a real treat, and I recommend it.
Yeah. Do you know the title of it?
Violence Girl.
Violence Girl. We will link that in the show notes, as well as your book, of course. They could have named her anything. The article you wrote for Literary Hub and all of your social media. Where can we find you if we want to connect further?
At Steph Says on Twitter and Instagram.
Excellent. We will put that there. You have just been so easy to talk to, and this conversation was so fulfilling. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. It was such a delight to be here.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.